This week on Life and Faith.
I bring this black body to every Bible verse that I bring because it's the only world in which I live. I don't live in another world. I live in the world where black people are killed for being black. And so to expect that not to influence me is to expect me not to be a human being.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. They just get their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
Well, this year, coronavirus has taken the whole world by surprise. And like many others, I'm sure, we've been horrified at how the pandemic has wreaked havoc in the United States. And at the same time, there's been a reckoning over racial injustice in America, sparked by the death in May of George Floyd. And we all know this story. A police officer knelt on his neck for 9 minutes during his arrest.
It was a shocking death, wasn't it, Simon? But I fear that it's tragically too familiar for many Black Americans. And if you read the transcript of what happened, George Floyd says to the police officer, "I can't breathe," around 20 times. And so it seems to really capture in terrifying detail just what African Americans have to fear about encounters with police.
Yeah, and I've been reading plenty of other stories like this since. It's actually horrifying and hard to fathom. And of course, we all know there's been protests and marches and debates about pulling down statues ever since. And you've also noticed, Justine, that there's some religious language that gets evoked on this issue.
Yeah, Simon, it's really interesting. Have a listen to this. It's Joe Biden. He's soon to be the Democratic presidential nominee, speaking on CNN after the murder of George Floyd.
The original sin of this country still stains our nation today. And sometimes we manage to overlook it. We just push forward with 1,000 other tasks in our daily life, but it's always there. In weeks like this, we see it plainly that we're a country with an open wound, and none of us can turn away. None of us can be silent. None of us can any longer can we hear the words, "I can't breathe," and do nothing.
That's Joe Biden on CNN. Original sin still stains America. I have to say, Justine, I can't imagine I've ever heard or perhaps ever will hear an Australian politician use that sort of language to describe injustice.
It is pretty shocking, isn't it? And what I've been interested to find is that it's not just Joe Biden. I've heard it in so many different American contexts, like reporters will say it. It's in articles. It's almost something of a cliche in the States. And obviously, there is a civil religion aspect to this as well, where in America, a lot of religious language and symbols get used in relation to the state and particularly in relation to national identity. But it does occur to me, just hearing Joe Biden talk, he doesn't specifically say what the sin is, but you can tell from his earlier comments, which you didn't hear, that he means slavery.
Yeah, it's an interesting reworking of this foundational Christian and Jewish idea that you get right at the beginning of the Bible in the book of Genesis. Now, people are probably at least a little bit aware of that story of Adam and Eve in the garden and their rejection of God, which the biblical story goes on to depict as having had catastrophic consequences for everyone and everything ever since. So that's the origin, anyway, of this idea of original sin. Now, how much of that Christian background gets its way into the metaphor is an interesting thing, I reckon, to ponder.
Yeah, this is exactly what I was curious about. So I got in touch with Esau Macaulay. He's an African-American theologian who's an assistant professor of New Testament at Wheaton College, which is a Christian college in Illinois in the US. He's written this blistering article on Black Rage and the Bible, and I'll make sure I link to it later on in the notes.
Yeah, so you wanted him to talk us through the intricacies of the way this language gets used, right?
Yeah, I started off by asking him what is commonly meant by the phrase, "America's original sin is slavery." And here's what he had to say.
What they're saying is that kind of this, the original sin, the first kind of major fall or brokenness that shows itself in America is through slavery. And so the analogy is that part of the American story is overcoming this deep devaluation of Black people when the country was first founded. And like the struggle to treat Black persons as fully human beings is sustained in America still struggling to do.
So there is a sense there that it's mostly to talk about the nation's origins, that it is founded in violence against Black people and people of color.
It's an analogy, right? It's not a perfect analogy, right? That, but it's saying that in the same way that the biblical story begins with this problem, sin, the American story begins with this problem, slavery. And like, I mean, that in one way, that's an oversimplification, right? Because you have what we did to the indigenous peoples here, what we did when we took huge parts of the West and kind of brought in our Latina brothers and sisters kind of into this grand American experiment. So yes, you can say in one sense that slavery is the original sin of this country, but the Native Americans might, I mean, our First Nations people might come and say, you know what? The original sin of America was the taking and the disruption of kind of the first peoples. And so original sin as it relates to Black people is just one way of talking about this racialized problem that exists in America.
And the way that people tend to use it, do you think that in a way they're also meaning the pervasiveness of, like,
yes,
there are ripple effects as well today?
Yeah, so in the same way that we think that sin in the Christian context impacts all every aspect of the human experience. And the in America, we're saying that racism, that kind of the racism that undergirded slavery, still impacts different parts of America, that it's not just gone away. And that unless this sin problem is dealt with in a real intentional way, that it's going to continue to plague us. And so it's kind of like this brokenness about our country that stalks us from decade to decade, century to century.
And so we can see that there is a lot of fruitful crossover between the metaphor of original sin being,
yes,
slavery,
yes,
and like the traditional teaching as well. Can you just tell me a little, I mean, maybe you could write a whole thesis on this, but maybe you can just sketch out some of the differences though as well.
Well, I guess what I would say is in the Christian story, sin kind of enters the world. And what happens then in America is just it's the continuation of that like sin that began before there was an America, right? And so from the Christian perspective, the sins of America, the founding sins of America, are just a small part of a larger story of human beings throughout time who have exploited and harmed one another as a result of our own brokenness before God. And so what we see nationally as it relates to the founding of America is seen interpersonally when one person robs another person, or when one person is dishonest or manipulative or uses their power for personal gain. And so America is a big version of a really small story that we see. And we see it in families, right? And all of the ways in which human brokenness affects interpersonal interaction. And so I want to say what's happening in America is a part of a bigger story that kind of branches out. When you have a person who is sinful, and then that sinful person has power, they can then use that power to disproportionately impact the lives of multiple people. And so when you get multiple sinful people and multiple centers of power, then you have systemic sin. And so systemic sin is nothing but the nationalization of a bunch of personal actions. And those personal actions kind of set in inequality. Let's just say, for example, underpaying workers, right? Because you want to build wealth for yourself. And so the best way to build wealth for yourself is to pay workers as little as possible in order to kind of have more profit. And so what you do is then you reduce kind of minimum wage. And so that's a structural inequality rooted in greed, where the greed, right, was matched to power. Someone who has no power and who is greedy, they can just buy themselves in the debt. But if you're greedy and you have power, then you can create inequalities in society. And so what we're struggling with is we can understand those inequalities in society when it relates to certain areas, but for whatever reason, talking about race seems to make people uncomfortable.
So if sin becomes the dominant metaphor, then in some ways you know, what advantage does that religious language bring rather than just simply saying, you know, oh, you know, America's national outrage is slavery? Like, sin does something different. Like, what's the advantage of that religious language?
When you call something sinful, you're speaking to kind of a transcendent moral norm. And that this is something that is clearly outrageous, not simply because it upsets us, because it is wrong on a fundamental level. And as a person of faith, that I think that what America does isn't simply like wrong to other human beings, but it offends God himself. And so calling it sinful is calling it what it is. And so that's the reason why I find at least the language of talking about American racism as sinful as being important.
It also seems to kind of invite considerations of justice, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Like all the stuff around the kind of debates over Confederate statues and, you know, NASCAR pulling the Confederate flag. Who saw that coming, right? There's something about being confronted with sin and trying to atone. I mean, this is the religious language that would be.
I think that like the interesting thing about like this conversation, if I could speak about it for a Christian, is that like we have in America, the American lexicon, and this is the tricky to talk about. We have sin, we have kind of atonement, but like we become the people who have, like, we don't have a very good doctrine of grace in this moment. And talking about grace or forgiveness is really difficult because forgiveness can sometimes be put over against justice, right? So I committed this sin, you should forgive me. It's like, no, that's not what I mean. What I want to say is that there's a brokenness in America that has to be repaired. Because there's a public brokenness, it needs to be a public repair. But after that public repair, there has to be some hope for community that isn't just retribution. And so if I can say I'm ever uncomfortable with some of the language that goes on, it's that there isn't always a vision of what comes after.
In the public square, right? It seems really kind of, yeah, angry right now. Is anyone wanting to even think about grace and forgiveness?
I think there has to be something on the other side of our rage. And on the cross, Jesus could have called down vengeance and death upon his enemies. But instead, he says, Father, forgive them. And so if there is something that a Christian has to offer to the cause for justice, it is not simply an amen to everything that the culture is already doing. It is saying, yes, God cares about the poor. Yes, God cares about the disinherited. But God cares about the oppressor too, and he wants both of them to be free. Because the oppressor is bound up in a false understanding of who he or she is, right? Like the racist whose identity is formed by the devaluation of black people is living a lie. And part of what we want to do is set them free from the lie. So they can be who God created them to be in the same way that we can be whom God created us to be.
We'll come back to Justine's interview with Esau Macaulay, an African-American Bible scholar, shortly. But remember what he said earlier, that Native Americans might dispute the idea that slavery was America's original sin. Instead, they'd probably say that their dispossession that predated slavery was the first stain or fracture in the nation. But what about the Australian context? Ray Minikin is a descendant of the Kabikabi and Gurangurang nations. He's a long-time Aboriginal activist who has ministered to and supported members of the Stolen Generations. He's also a pastor at St. John's Church in Glebe in Sydney's Inner West. I asked him what comes to mind when he hears the phrase, the original sin of the nation.
Oh, lots of things. I mean, it depends on which way you want to look at it. From a political viewpoint, it means to us the invasion of our lands. It means the disobedience of those laws. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt honour your neighbours, love your neighbour as yourself. It's all of those laws that God has put in place that we have broken, that the illegal entry of another person into someone else's Garden of Eden, if you want to call it that, our sacred place. Then that's the desecration that has taken place since 1788, or even 1770, if you want to go back to the planting of the flag by James Cook on Possession Island.
When you've seen in recent weeks the great outcry after the death of George Floyd in the US, and then people kind of finding parallels in our own nation's history. What's been your sense of this, and for your people, what has this story meant as it's sort of resonated across the world?
For me, the whole story of Black Lives Matter started in 1788. And if you look at the ways in which our people have been treated from 1788, black lives do matter. Our country does matter. Our nations do matter. Those who have been the invaders of our country do matter. I not only just to us, I think to our Creator as well, who in our understanding as Indigenous peoples, our Creator gave us this land. This is His gift to us, and that He gave us responsibility to look after it. And so we see this, Black Lives Matter is an ongoing drama, an ongoing story, an ongoing bruise, wound in our nation's history. So it is, you could call, the nation's original sin. And it comes out of those incredible attitudes and behaviours. And if we look at the biblical story again of Genesis 3, I think the very first thing that Adam was displayed in his attitudes and behaviours was denial. And so we live in this country here under huge, high levels of denial that this event that took place in 1788 was an action that was ordered by God. We don't believe that as Aboriginal people that it was, because it did come with a lot of brutality and genocide and those kind of challenges that we still face today. And I think it's based upon four very, very powerful attitudes that are very difficult for the non-Indigenous people, in Australians, to really come to grips with. And it's those major attitudes that I think came with the original sin in this nation. Denial, arrogance, hypocrisy, apathy, ignorance, they're all part of the whole package that we could say that it is a part of this nation's original sin.
Have the events in recent weeks and protests and activity, have they been things that have given you kind of optimism, or like has that felt like something of a change possibly in the wind or not? I mean, you mentioned it's been a very long story for your people.
Well, we hope it is. It has to have some kind of repercussions in terms of some kind of justice, whatever that justice looks like. For our people, what we're saying is our jails are full, let's empty them. How do we do that together? If the police are racially profiling Aboriginal people, which they are, and I've had those experiences, then how do we change that, those attitudes? And if we're not getting the right educational or housing or other kind of, why aren't we getting that now from those who have brought this new culture and then their systems into our country? So there's, I don't see what you would call the changes, systemic changes that are necessary to make those things happen. And if you look at the request from the Statement from the Heart from 2017, it just asked for three things. One, a treaty. Two, a voice in Parliament. And thirdly, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that can highlight the whole horrors and the brutality and the rape of our people since 1788. Those kinds of sins need to be exposed, because as the scriptures say, the truth shall set us free. And if we don't have the truth there to look at and confront us, how then can we be free as a people and as a nation?
Do you think that a proper reckoning with the sins of the past can lead to much more positive outcomes then?
It can lead to a much more positive hope that we could work together. And we're, you know, most of us have seen these kind of hopes established in countries like South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the ways in which they dealt with the sins of their nation. Also in Canada, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has exposed once again the lies and the brutalities of the, for them, the their stolen generation, the residential schools that the churches had control of. And even in this country here, we've only been exposed to these particular brutalities in the last 20 or so years. I mean, you know, we've been living under the notion of terra nullius in this country. That particular lie wasn't removed from the consciousness of the country legally until 1993 with the Mabo decision. And so we've been living these lies for far too long. And until those lies are addressed, or which are the sins of the nation, then how on earth can we start to work out a much more better future?
You're listening to Life and Faith from CPX, and we're talking about how the Christian idea of original sin gets used in discussions of historic and systemic racism in the United States and Australia.
We're going to get back to my interview with Esau Macaulay. In a New York Times op-ed called What the Bible Has to Say About Black Anger, Esau wrote that the cross makes sense of the lynching tree. I asked him to walk us through what he meant by that.
There's the standard Christian way of talking about who Jesus is. He died for our sins, and he's the means by which we're reconciled to God. And all of that is true. But it is also true that Jesus was a member of a ethnic minority group in the Roman Empire. And it is also true that the Roman Empire used crucifixion as a way of instilling fear in the populace. And what I mean is the point of the crucifixion was to show this is what happens when you get out of line. It was a deterrent. The crucifixion wasn't just for Jesus. It was for all of the people who were there. And there was crucifixions all throughout the Roman Empire that basically were a form of kind of terror upon a populace to keep them in check. And so the lynchings functioned in the same way, right? The lynchings were designed to keep people in their place. If a black person gets out of place, they're lynched. So Jesus' defeat of death on the cross shows us that the state doesn't get to say who is valued by God, right? So the state says, Jesus, you are a problem, I will kill you. And God's vindication of Jesus says, no, you're my son. And so when I say the cross helps us make sense of the lynching tree, is that like my value is not rooted in what my oppressor says about me. My value is based upon what God says about me. And God says that if I trust in his son, that I'm one of his children. And so it helps me understand like that the lynching tree doesn't speak the final word about the value of black life. Because there's pictures in America that you can find right now of people who oppose in front of lynchings, where there will be a black body that is burned in the background. And you see families standing around the lynching site, taking family photos. You can also find people who would take bones and pieces of the bodies with them from the lynching home as like souvenirs. And so that is a devaluation of the black person. But God says that is not who we are. We're who God says we are, and God says we're all image bearers. God says that we're all of infinite value because we are created in his image.
Of course, you know, the Bible has been used to support and justify slavery as well as argue against it. So who does the text speak for? Does it speak for an oppressor or the oppressed?
When we were first like taught the Bible, they gave us an edited Bible. So they didn't tell, the African-American Christians didn't get the parts of the Bible that had the Exodus in it. They were just given the parts of the Bible that says slaves be obedient to your masters. Now, if the white slave masters thought that the whole Bible spoke to black, to their ability to enslave, they would give us the whole Bible, right? The fact that even the slave masters edited the Bible knew that there's something that they knew that in the Bible that created this sense that God wants people to be free. And the other thing that happens is that once African-Americans in particular got access to these texts, they said, one of the first things that they said, you can read it in the literature, the depiction of God that was given to me by the enslavers was a fundamentally false one. And so Black Christianity is an example of someone who comes to these texts as an oppressed group and says, the same God who liberated the Jews has a desire to liberate us as well. And so, yes, the Bible has been used to do tremendous evil, but the Bible has also been a source of hope. This is the title of my book, right? Reading While Black, African-American Biblical Interpretation as an Exercise in Hope. Because I want to argue is that Bible reading has always been a source of hope in African-American communities. And so I want to say that we think, if we're allowed to speak for ourselves, that this book speaks for our freedom and not for our enslavement.
So from what I understand, you come from a family of ministers and you grew up in Alabama in a racially divided city. And you've had that, I mean, you talk about reading while black, you've had the experience of driving while black and being pulled over. So this is personal. This is steeped. Your history is steeped in this.
I grew up in a South where from my childhood, I knew that there were people who were, it was actually two things. One, there's black joy. And I think there's a part that doesn't always come through. I grew up in a black church with great music and great preaching and like an all-black high school with an amazing marching band and sports teams. And so there was this sense of within our community, there was a real sense of joy and celebration. But there was also this sense in which there was that for some people, my skin made me dangerous. And making sense of what it meant to live in America that judged me on sight was something that kind of marked how I read the Bible. Because I came to the Bible saying, does God care about what is happening to us? And that's the question that I bring. And in that sense, it's not different from anyone else, right? If you're kind of a single person who's trying to find their spouse, what does the Bible say about me being a person of faith who's single? How does the Bible speak to me as someone who's married or someone who's had many miscarriages or who's gone through difficult things in life? We all bring our experiences to the text. And I bring this black body to every Bible verse that I bring because it's the only world in which I live. I don't live in another world. I live in the world where black people are killed for being black. And so to expect that not to influence me is to expect me not to be a human being. It's to expect a woman not to be influenced by her gender.
Yeah. And was church, I'm hoping that it was a respite from the racial divides that were everywhere around, but was it?
The church was a source of hope. So when everybody's telling you that you're less than a human, when they say, you're more likely to end up in jail than with a college degree, and that in a world that told you that you couldn't, the church was the place that told me I could with God's help. It was African Americans who say, despite all the stuff that they say about you, you can be anything that you want to be with God's help. And so, yes, it was a segregated, hostile society outside the church. But inside the church, we were told that God cared about us and he cared about what happened to us.
So that was a predominantly African American church?
All black.
Yeah.
Everybody was black. Yeah. There was one white guy in the church who would say, I'm the president of the white people committee. He would say that every time another white person visited, which is not very often. The sad thing about this, and people don't understand this, is that what we had to do is we had to put a picture of our pastor on, this is back before the internet, so your young people might not realize this, but you used to go to find churches by looking in a phone book. And so when we would just have the name of our church, it was Union Hill Baptist Church, and a white family would come in and they would see an all black church and they would just leave. And it got so heartbreaking seeing people come in and leave, we just put the black pastor's picture on the sign and in the newspaper or the phone book, so that people would know, okay, if you come to this church, know there's going to be black people here. And so yes, we lived in a segregated church, but it wasn't because we didn't want like black white people in the church. It's that they didn't want to be a part of our community.
Can I quote James Baldwin to you? I mean, this is a famous quote. You know it off by heart, surely. You know, to be a Negro in this country and to be relatively conscious is to be in a state of rage almost all of the time. Do you agree? What do you think?
When you recognize that what happened here was not simply a series of kind of unfortunate incidents, but it was a coordinated, systemic program to keep us from freedom, the only thing that is left for you to feel is like this deep sense of anger. And this is why I say, like, for me, the reason that I can like function well in this country is because I'm a Christian. Because I know I failed personally. Forget America. I have done wrong. And I have failed in profound ways. But God has forgiven me. And because God has forgiven me through his son Jesus, that gives me the theological resources to imagine something beyond retribution, right? If there is no God and there is no kind of transcendent moral norm, well, let's just get revenge, right? Why not? Why not get revenge? Why not burn the thing to the ground? But if there is this sense in which there's this moral order to the universe, then maybe there can be this brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity on the other side of what we're experiencing now. And so, yes, I'm upset. But I'm also, as a Christian, like the statement, Father, forgive them, that Jesus gave on the cross, like affects my psyche. And so, and it affects the psyche of African-American Christians all throughout the country who have a deep sense of what we want is not revenge. We want justice and freedom.
It seems to me that what you're doing is you're bringing that Christian story into conversation with the national story that you know, how you talk about the glory story, and you want to challenge that glory story, even if that triggers people.
Part of being a Christian is telling the truth, right? You can't lie to people. And what happened in this country was, you know, we like to tell the story that we came here for freedom of religion, and we created this wonderful democracy, and then we created this amazing economy, and we managed to have this military, and we kind of exported democracy to the rest of the world. The truth of the matter is, American democracy was built on slave labor, right? It was built on the robbing of the Native Americans and the First Nations people, the African American slave labor, the exploitation out west of Korean, Japanese, and Chinese in successive order, labor to the, and so like, and plus the reliance upon the exploitation of Latino labor. So like, there's just a history of this country being built on the back of exploitation. And that is a story that we have to come to grips with, because it can't be required for me to be in community with you to believe a lie. And the lie is the inability to wrestle with the deep brokenness. Yes, there is a story of American greatness, but that story is not the story of an America that is innocent. The story that the part that makes America great is that in spite of these tremendous odds, right, we're still here.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart with Justine Toe. Thanks today to Esau McCauley and Ray Minikin for talking to us about America and Australia's original sins. And thanks to our producer, Anthea Godsmark.
We're going to post a link to Esau's forthcoming book, Reading While Black, African American Biblical Interpretation as an Exercise in Hope, as well as his New York Times opinion piece on black anger. He's recently become a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, so keep an eye out for his columns in future. You can also follow him on Twitter at Esau McCauley. We'll also link to a powerful interview Ray Minikin did with Larissa Berent on the ABC during Easter this year.
We're working hard at CPX to contribute to a positive conversation about faith, meaning, the things that matter. Everything we produce here seeks to do just that, and it's all made possible by supporters who donate to us, and we love you to consider doing just this. Every bit counts. Go to lifeandfaithpodcast.com to find out more. Next week.
Many of us like technology. We enjoy using it. And these things begin to impinge on human, not only in human capacity, but on the other hand, it's infringing on and impinging on the concept of human identity, what we human beings are. And I feel that's where a lot of the thinking ought to be done, because this is really the first generation or the first couple of generations that have the technological power to influence the very nature and make up of future generations of, well, I could say human beings, but would they be human?